Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Dr. David Anders, our guest this hour. You know him from Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders on EWTN each day. And maybe you've gotten to see him speak or read what he has written. But really one of the most popular and beloved figures in Catholic media right now. And I think it's because every time he gives an answer, people go, wow, what a great answer. I've gotten to hear him speak. I've listened to the show many, many times. It got me through COVID. I can tell you that. I listened to that show every day during COVID. And I think I told you, Dr. Anders, at the time, it's the best show in radio. I love that show. So thank you very much for being here with us.
Well, I really appreciate that. And I'll tell you, when we were locked down during COVID, I was not going into the studio on a regular basis. And we were doing the show by Skype, you know, and other internet resources. And the internet connection in my house was pretty spotty. And so those days we had a few broadcasts where we kind of phased in and out during the
I was a little fevery at the time, so maybe I was just experiencing that as entertaining. I'm not sure, but I do want people to know that in addition to being a beloved radio broadcaster, Catholic broadcaster, Dr. Anders is truly hated by the devil. And I know that because his house got hit by lightning. He was.
Yes, this is true.
Oh my gosh! I haven't even. So you're not like you had to go home to do the radio show, but you can't even do your show from home now. If your electricity was blown up.
I'm not in my own house. I'm actually in my son's house right now because I would have taken the call normally at my own house, but yesterday. Morning, about 9 a.m. local time, we got hit by lightning, and it blew out the GFCIs in my house. It took out, fried my internet, destroyed my router and my Wi-Fi extenders, took out a bunch of lamps, and then singed my dryer, interestingly, blew a hole in the side of my foundation, knocked some bricks off the side of my house, and cracked the concrete where we had sunk one of the pylons for our backyard fence. So it was
that is an insane amount of power of energy that shot through your house.
It was insane. I'm really glad I wasn't outside sitting on the fence at that time.
Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that in a thunderstorm.
In a thunderstorm, yeah.
No, don't do that.
That was not a good thing.
Wow, that's amazing. All right, but you're willing to take any questions today. People can ask you anything if they'd like.
Yeah, I'll do my best to answer, but you know, I'm not real strong on particle physics, I'll tell you that. But
he knows what it's like to be on the receiving end of the lightning, but don't ask him how the lightning works. 888-318-7884. I know how the lightning works, though. I'm actually an expert in that. If the devil really hates the work you're doing on EWTN, he just throws it down at you. He throws a lightning bolt at you. That's what happened. That's science. I know it's a guy. I didn't mean to get too science-y on you, but that's a little bit of science for you. 888-318-7884, the number, if you'd like to talk with Dr. David Anders. Everywhere I go, Dr. Anders, people say, I just love that that Called to Communion show. It's really has captured people. I think part of it is certainly a great deal of it has to do with the quality of your answers. But there's also just this spirit of it that I think encourages Catholics, which is there's a reasonable answer to these things. Don't be afraid of questions. A hard question is a Catholic's best friend in a way.
So, you know, there's a reasonable answer, but there is not a deductively certain answer to every question you might raise. And I say that because the Church actually teaches, believe it or not, it is a heresy to hold that you can compel the act of faith through deductive argument. Yeah. It's like if somebody comes to you and says, and this happens on the air a lot of times, people will call and say, Anders, you know, my son or my daughter or my cousin or my wife or whoever left the church, what can I say that will make them come back to the church? Right. And the true answer is nothing can make them come back to the church. There's no argument that can compel the reason to give assent to the data of revelation, because the data of revelation transcends reason. Like, there are articles of faith that you cannot know rationally to be true. You have to take them on authority. But it doesn't mean it's irrational. There's a difference. There's a difference between something being rationally demonstrative and something that is, that's absolutely irrational. And they're not. It's neither one of those. So what the church says is that it's kind of like marriage. There are good reasons to marry your spouse, ideally, hopefully, and we can lay those out. But at the end of the day, you have to make a commitment of yourself, right? That transcends what mere reason can show you. And guys, my computer just told me that my battery is running low and my son's outlet seems not to be charging. So if we suddenly get cut off, I'm going to log right back in. While we're talking, I got to make sure I can charge this darn computer, right?
This is what I'll do. If you get cut off, I'll just go like, I'll answer the question, what Dr. Anders would have said, and then I'll just make
what
something
What Anders
up.
Would have said. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that works.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. But this point that you're making about the faith is it has to be faith. It can't just be knowledge. It can't be that we but sometimes there is the thing where the person intellectually it becomes convinced of the faith. But that conviction transcends the argument that was made. It's not because the argument was airtight.
So what Cardinal Newman says is actually quite brilliant. He wrote a great book about 150 years ago called An Essay in Aid of a Grammar of Assent. I also just found an outlet in aid of Catholic Answers. I found an outlet that works in my son's house, so I don't think we're going to get cut off after all. Anyway, in that book, Essay in Aid of a Grammar of Assent, he asks the question, what does it actually mean to assent to a proposition? And what he wants to discern is, you know, do people assent to propositions because they've been demonstrated, right, from self-evident first principles?
Right.
And Newman concludes, well, no, that's not how it works. That's not how most people reason. And in fact, you know, since Newman, there's been a lot of social science and psychology that's basically confirmed that, right?
Right.
That instead what happens is that people have basic intuitions about the world, intuitions about what's good, what's true, what's beautiful, what's normal, what's natural. And if you come to them with an argument that confirms their basic intuitions, then they're likely to regard that argument as compelling. And if it violates those basic intuitions, then they're probably not going to accept it, no matter how deductively logical it might be. I heard a great illustration of this one time from Peter Kreft, you know, the Catholic philosopher. And he was describing a course he taught in ethics at Boston College, and he was arguing to the class that abortion and infanticide were morally equivalent. And if you're gonna have an abortion, you might as well do infanticide, because there's really no substantive difference between the two. And his goal, of course, was to get people to realize that abortion is wrong, because most people are going to recognize infanticide is just terrible, so, you know, abortion's terrible too. And after the lecture, he said these two women came up to him and said, well, you did a great job, and you've utterly convinced us. We agree with you now. We believe that abortion and infanticide are morally equivalent. And he says, oh, good, so now you're against abortion. They said, oh, no, now we're in favor of infanticide.
Good Lord.
And the point is that they had a basic moral intuition that the highest moral value was personal autonomy and self-determination. Right? And so then they're gonna interpret data according to that basic intuition. And so Kreft gave them a very good deductive argument.
Yep.
But it didn't land at all the way he thought it would land. Okay.
Yeah.
And so what that means for evangelism is that it's good to present arguments for the faith, but we have to embed those arguments in a life.
Right.
That's compelling in a way that's pre-rational, not irrational, not anti-rational, but it's pre-rational. And we have to invite people into relationship, into fellowship, into an experience of the church and of grace and of God and of Christian fellowship that reorients their basic intuitions about the world. The arguments for the faith will begin to resonate when previously they were just so much noise. You know, when my second, actually the son whose house I'm sitting in right now, he and I had a kind of cantankerous relationship when he was in high school. That's not unusual. He's a grown man now, but, you know, it's not unusual for fathers and sons to kind of be at loggerheads when the boy is 17. And he said to me one time, he said, "Daddy, you are right. You're always right about everything, and nobody cares."
Ooh.
You know, and that's the point I'm making, right?
Yeah.
It's one thing to be, it's one thing to be right, to have the argument, right? But if you don't embed that in a moral, human, embodied social, cultural context that makes sense to people, then it just seems like you're blowing hot air to them.
Is that, when you say that, I think of the Lord's own words in the Sermon on the Mount, "Let your light so shine before men that they'll see your good works and glorify God." Is that what you're...
That is so dead on accurate. And you know, when Peter, there's one passage in the New Testament that talks about apologetics, and it's in St. Peter's Epistle, chapter 3. And what Peter says, he doesn't say, always be ready to go beat your neighbor over the head with the Catechism of the Catholic Church. He doesn't say that. What he says is, always be ready to give an answer for people who ask you about your hope.
Yeah.
And so to me, that presumes that apologetics is there to answer questions when people are ready to ask them.
Yes, right.
But what is it that makes them ready to ask?
And I think
it's that they've had some experience of the church, of a Catholic person, maybe a book or some evidence of history. So they've encountered some empirical fact that challenges their view of what's good, true, and beautiful. And then they go looking, well, how can I make sense of that experience? And then they turn to apologetics. In my own life, I can remember a signature moment when I was studying church history, and I found evidence that the ancient church was deeply engaged in the veneration of saints and relics, deeply engaged. And I had a basic intuition about the world, namely that the early church was probably closer to the truth than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And discovering that the ancient church was heavily engaged in the cult of relics and saints violated a lot of my convictions as a Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
But it also was challenged by this underlying conviction or intuition that I should respect antiquity. After I had that experience, I went looking for apologetics in the Catholic tradition that could make sense of relics to me, that could make sense of saints to me. If you just handed me an argument for veneration of saints, it wouldn't have landed.
Yeah.
I had to go have an empirical experience of Christian life in antiquity before the argument was interesting to me. You follow what I'm saying?
I do. I feel like the argument you're making is an argument against a kind of evangelization that involves tweeting out smart aleck Catholic comments to other people.
I am not a fan of tweeting out smart aleck Catholic comments to other people.
I thought maybe.
Do you know who Megan Phelps Roper is?
I don't. I'm sorry. No.
Okay. So, she was involved in the Westboro Baptist Church, I believe.
Okay.
And, you know, which kind of had a reputation for kind of the going out and taking an aggressive stance with people in the world. And I think they raised a lot of controversy about that. And I read her autobiography, and she talks about a stage in her life when she was engaged in a pretty kind of aggressive apologetic, promoting the particulars of her particular group, you know, online. And there were people who responded to her with a lot of aggression and hostility. But there were a few interlocutors that were very patient and kind and genuinely interested and asked her questions and drew her out. And it was their sort of kind, patient, faithful questioning that ultimately led her to re-examine the basis of her convictions. And she ultimately ended up leaving that community because of that engagement. And it was a lesson that I learned from her about the importance of genuine listening, genuine questioning, open-ended dialogue. You know, if you come at somebody with aggression, then they're likely to just throw up the defenses and, you know, and fight back. But if you take the stance of accompaniment, listening, dialogue, and charity, you really can move the conversation along in the direction of truth.
Dr. David Anders is our guest. If you're not a Catholic and you'd like to ask about the Catholic faith, we'd love it if you'd call this hour, 888-318-7884. There's four lines open at the moment. I have to take just a very quick break, and then we'll come back and get some calls on for Dr. David Anders on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live. Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit MysticMonkCoffee.com. That's MysticMonkCoffee.com.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with the gospel message. EWTN is the most trusted source of authentically Catholic content on the air today, featuring Mother Angelica, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and Father Benedict Groeschel. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Dr. David Anders is our guest. In addition to the other things that I said about him being a beloved Catholic broadcaster and writer and speaker and all that, I did neglect to mention that he himself is a convert to the Catholic faith. He alluded to it, but if you are, maybe you have not, you're not a convert to the Catholic faith, but you'd like to ask a question about a Catholic faith. If it's a challenging question, Dr. David Anders is the person to confront with your challenging question. We're happy to have you. Again, the number is 888-318-7884. I always feel good about asking people to ask challenging questions of other people. It's a great thing about being the host. Yes, ask your hardest question to Dr. David Anders, 888-318-7884. Dr. Anders, you feel comfortable going to the phones?
Let's do it.
All right, let's go to Diane down in Florida. Diane, we're awful glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Anders.
Hi, it's nice for you to take my call. I appreciate it. I'm a convert from like 45 years ago in my young life.
Oh, God bless you.
Thanks. It's wonderful, wonderful. It gets better all the time. I thought that I heard one of the guests on the show a few weeks ago say, answer a question. The question came in, if a priest walked into a bakery and said the words of consecration, would that bread all turn to the precious body and blood of Jesus? So I misunderstood the answer. I must have misunderstood the answer. I'd like to have clarification on that, please. And I think it was Dr. David Anders, but it could have been Jimmy Akins. I'm not sure. Do you remember that at all? I'd like to listen.
So really appreciate the question. It would not have been I. It was not I, because I was not on the show a few weeks ago. This is actually the first time I've been on Catholic Answers in a while. I don't think we've done this for a couple of months at least, Zoe. So
right,
it couldn't have been me. All right. But in terms of, could a priest walk into a bakery and say the words of the consecration over the baked goods and have them become the body of Christ? So you understand that the proper matter for Holy Mass is bread and wine. Bread and wine. And if the priest doesn't have both elements, then he cannot intend the sacrifice of the Mass. He can't have the proper intent if he doesn't have both elements present. Graham Greene, the Catholic novelist, wrote a magnificent novel called, I believe it's called The Power and the Glory. Isn't that the name of the book?
Yeah, about the Mexican priest.
And yeah, it's about a Mexican priest who's trying to flee the country during that anti-clerical persecution of the church that took place in the early 20th century. And his life's in danger and people are trying to kill him. And he keeps getting drawn back in to say the sacraments for people. And he ultimately dies a martyr. But along the way, he has this very strong desire to celebrate Mass. He really, really wants to celebrate Mass. But the problem is the government has a lock on all alcohol. And it's very, very hard to get a hold of a bottle of wine. And so he's got bread. He's got wheat and bread, but he can't get the wine. And he goes through this big rigmarole. He finally manages to bribe somebody into giving him a bottle of wine, but it involves a government official, and the government official insists on sharing it with him. And long story short is the government official ends up drinking the whole thing in his face, and he has no wine left, so he can't say Mass. He ends up never being able to say Mass because he doesn't have proper matter for Mass. So I think the hypothetical that you raise is an impossibility. I don't think there's any situation in which a priest could walk into a bakery and casually say the words and have the proper intent, let alone the proper matter to intend to consecrate the elements into the body and blood of Christ. Now, what he could do is he could take some bread from the bakery, go next door to the liquor store, nab a bottle of wine, you know, take the proper matter for the Eucharist, and then go off in a corner and say Mass, right? But the way you've described the setting, I can't see that he would have proper intent, and he certainly wouldn't have the proper matter to intend the Holy Sacrifice, which requires the two elements.
Okay, Diane, makes sense?
Saying that, could I ask another question? Please. Are you saying that it doesn't have to be unleavened bread?
So in the Latin Church, proper matter is unleavened bread, all right? In the Eastern Church, you can have leavened bread. What would happen if you had a situation in the Latin Church where, for whatever reason, under conditions of persecution or scarcity or whatnot, unleavened bread was not available, and the only bread you could have would be leavened bread? I'm not a sacramental theologian myself, and I'm not open to all the rubrics, but my intuition says that in extremis like that, he could celebrate the Mass with leavened bread. But I'm totally open to correction if somebody wants to call in who's a priest and knows more about that than I do and says, no, even in extremis, you couldn't do that because the proper matter for the Latin Church is unleavened. I'm not 100% sure on that question, but, that's my intuition.
Diane, I'm going to say thank you and move on. Lots of folks on the line. There is a line open if you'd like to get in the queue to talk with Dr. David Anders. If you're not a Catholic, we'd love to take your call today, 888-318-7884. Tyler is in Colorado. Tyler, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Dr. David Anders.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
We're happy to.
So I don't want to say that, I don't believe. So I believe in Jesus Christ. It's not really, that's not where I want to go with this. My issue is, why should I follow Catholicism and not just Christianity? And then more specifically, the Latin Catholicism, when my issue is, how do I contend with the fact that the Vatican can change traditions that are in the Bible? Like, why is that okay? Like, does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, I'm totally with you. Okay. So first of all, the category of Christianity, the intellectual mm-hmm. category is something called Christianity that is a broad tent that encompasses Catholicism as one of its elements. That way of conceiving the thing is extremely modern, very, very, very modern. And if you were to go back to the New Testament era, to the first century, to the second century, to the fourth century, to the eighth century, to the 12th century, you wouldn't find anyone who practiced the Christian faith that had that conception, that thought of things in those terms. The idea of denominationalism, the idea that Christianity is a kind of big tent religion in which you have all these sort of disparate little groups that clump together with their different beliefs, that really is a remnant of the 18th century. And there have always been different Christian groups, but the one thing they all had in common going back for 1800 years was the belief that Christ intended for there to be a singular historical institution and that you needed to belong to that one singular historical institution, and then everybody else was a kind of interloper and a pretender. It's just that everybody thought their group was that one singular institution. So in the 16th century, for example, after the Calvinist church had broken away from the Catholic church, John Calvin encountered some Anabaptists. Those are the precursors to modern-day Baptists and Mennonites and Amish. And he particularly was in dialogue with a man named Herman. And if you read Calvin's letters, he remarks, he says, Herman admits that outside the church there is no salvation and that the true church is with us, meaning namely with us, the Calvinists, and that he was in a state of schism or defection by not belonging. See, so Calvin also would have confessed, Calvin, who was not a Catholic, would have confessed the doctrine that there is but one holy Catholic and apostolic church. He just thought that was his, right? Luther thought the same way. Luther did not believe in denominationalism. Luther thought that there was a singular historical institution and that his reform had restored the Catholic Church to that pristine condition, and that if you were outside of his version of Christianity, that you were outside of redemption. And so he wrote about Ulrich Zwingli, who was the Swiss Protestant reformer. He said, one of us is with God and one of us is with Satan, and I'm with God. Namely, Zwingli is with Satan. Right. So the first thing I want to just remark is it doesn't matter who you ask, whether you talk to a Catholic or a Protestant or whoever, nobody thought of the church in those terms. Now, why didn't they think of them in those terms? Well, because Jesus himself makes no comment about an abstract category called Christianity. Instead, what Christ speaks about is an historical institution called the church. And he uses the phrase a couple of times, most prominently in Matthew chapter 16, when he says to St. Peter — Peter was going by the name Simon, he changes his name to Peter, which means rock — and he says to him, thou art Peter, in other words, you're rock, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Now, to be specific, he says to Peter, I give you — well, here I give you the interlude music is what I give you.
Yeah, right.
So maybe we have to come to this, finish this call after the break. So hang with us.
Tyler, I'll let you respond to Dr. David Anders as well. It would be wonderful if we could make it a little bit of a conversation. So don't go anywhere, Tyler. Dr. David Anders is our guest. Our number is 888-318-7884.
Deepen your connection to the church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the church fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
On Tuesday's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, our topic is, how good are you at living in the now moment? And now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. Dr. David Anders is our guest. You can check out Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders anytime, actually. You can stream it as a podcast. You can listen to it live on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. And if you do, you'll be in the company of lots and lots of other people who love that program. Tyler is on the line in Colorado and asking just the perfect question that we'd love to have asked here. Why? Why be a Catholic? Tyler says he accepts Jesus Christ as who Jesus claims himself to be. But why Catholicism over, say, some other Christian denomination? And you were in the midst of an answer, Dr. Anders.
Yeah, so he asked why not follow sort of generic Christianity as opposed to Catholicism? And I began by saying, well, the whole concept of a generic Christianity is actually a pretty modern idea. And you don't find any evidence for that in the teaching of Jesus or in the New Testament or in the first centuries of the church or even the first 1,000 years of the church. Nobody had a concept of a generic Christianity because Christ himself didn't teach it. And Christ actually speaks about a specific visible institution that he calls the church. And church means, you know, those who have been gathered or called out, so they recognizably such. And he famously uses the phrase in Matthew chapter 16 when he says to St. Peter, "Thou art Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and I give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven," which is a sign of executive authority. "And whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven." He says, whoever hears you hears me. Whoever rejects you rejects me. And a few other places he uses the concept of church. One would be Matthew chapter 18, where in the concept of church discipline, he talks about people that can be admitted to or excluded from that gathered community. And you know, if they are unrepentant, you kick them out of, quote, the church and treat them as a tax collector. And if they repent, you bring them back into the church. And so, you know, he's not talking about an abstract entity here, but a concrete, visible association with lines of demarcation that can mark out people who are in and people who are out, right? And he established a certain visible leadership over that community. 12 knocked down to 11 specific individuals and gave them a charge that they go through the nations and make disciples and administer the sacraments, like baptism in particular, teach them everything that Christ commanded. So he had a visible institution in mind with lines of authority, a concrete, definite body of faith to be transmitted, and practices, rituals that would mark out entrance and exit from that community, right? So that's not a generic entity, and it's not an abstract entity. It's a very specific specific entity. And when you keep reading in the New Testament, it's evident that this was not just a local phenomena, but it had universal scope. So St. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, for example, can talk about people who dissent from the practices of that body. And he says, if anyone is contentious or has another practice, know that we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. So he points to what we would call Catholic consensus, that there's a common expression and life of the faith that you can find across the world that as a norm of Christian belief and behavior, right? So we're hearing about, it's starting to sound an awful lot like what we mean Catholicism is. Acts chapter 14, we learn that when the apostles were traveling through the world and teaching the doctrine of Christ, that they were specifically appointing successors in individual congregations. These are people that were appointed by the apostles themselves. And in the pastoral epistles, Timothy and Titus, we see that appointment, you know, as a personal charism passed from person to person with the charge to teach the faith and to teach it with authority and to reconcile sinners and this kind of thing. And so by the time you get to the second century, like the very next generation after the apostles, some of the earliest writing we have outside of the New Testament is specifically about the continuity of this institution. And so Paul wrote a letter to the Corinthian church, kind of getting on to them for some of their bad behavior. One of the things they were doing was forming factions. And he says, no, you can't form factions. You have to agree on everything. Right after Paul, Clement of Rome, who's a very early bishop of Rome, writes another letter to the Corinthians saying, hey, you know, guys, you can't actually kick out the leadership that Paul put in place. That was put there by apostle, so that has mm-hmm. apostolic authority behind it. So you got to hang with that leadership. Over in Antioch, there's a bishop in Antioch. He was the third bishop of Antioch after Peter. His name was Ignatius. He's doing the same thing. He says, you can only accept that doctrine and that Eucharist that's in unity with the bishop that stands in direct continuity to the apostles appointed by Christ. And you flip over to southern France, and you get a bishop by the name of Irenaeus. And he again points to this concept of Catholic unanimity across the ancient world, particularly represented in the bishopric or the See of Rome. And he says, if you want to know what official Christian doctrine is, you have to agree with the teaching of the Roman Church on account of the authority and the nobility of its founders, namely Peter and Paul. And so you find in the New Testament itself, and in the immediate heirs to the New Testament, the concept that Christ established a visible institution. Now, you might ask yourself the question, well, what's the utility of a visible institution, right? Well, you know, the problem with the concept of a kind of generic Christianity, as it were, is, well, you know, I can't believe generically in something, right? I can't believe generically in, like, having a wife. I have a specific wife, right? You know? There's no generic doctrine. There are specific practices and beliefs that Jesus instituted. And it's important that I know what those are. And the problem with generic Christianity is there's no common center to the thing. There's literally nothing on which all quote-unquote generic Christians agree. And so Christ said, whoever believes and is baptized will be saved. Well, believes in what? right? What's the concrete body of doctrine that I have to hold? What are the practices that I need to engage in? What's the moral or the ethic that I need to follow? There's literally no consistent answer to that question within quote-unquote generic or abstract Christianity. There are specific teaching held by specific churches or institutions, and there's only one of those that can claim continuity for 2,000 years down with the one founded by Jesus. Now, you raised a question about, you know, why Latin Catholicism? Well, you don't have to follow Latin Catholicism, right? The Catholic doctrine is that the Catholic Church is all of the Christians throughout the world that are in union with the Bishop of Rome and those bishops in union with the Bishop of Rome. Some of those are Latin. Some of them are non-Western. Some of them are Eastern. Some of them are Greek. Some of them are Coptic. Some of them are Arabian. Some of them are from the Indian subcontinent. And they have different rites and different traditions and different theological expressions. But because of that Catholic unity they share with the Bishop of Rome, we call them Catholic. And so it's perfectly legitimate to become an Eastern Rite Catholic as opposed to a Latin Rite Catholic. The important thing is simply to be in continuity with those churches founded by apostles. They can trace their heritage back to Christ. Now, does it make a concrete difference in the way I live? Well, yeah, let me give you a few concrete, specific instances. Well, let's take ethical questions, for example. Is it okay to kill babies in the womb? Well, that is a question that you may have to confront someday. There may be a woman in your life that is trying to make a decision about that, and you are somehow implicated in that decision. You'll need an answer to that question. Is it licit or not? Well, there are a lot of generic Christian churches that would answer that question in the affirmative. Yes, it's licit to kill babies in the womb. But the Catholic Church says, no, it's not licit to kill babies in the womb. Right? That's a concrete difference that it makes in your faith and practice. Right? I could multiply examples, but I think one is sufficient to make the point. There's no concrete body of belief in the abstract entity Christianity, but there is in the concrete reality that we call Catholicism.
Tyler, I want to come back to you and see what you think of all that.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything that he said. My issue that I'm currently facing is, so I'm reading long story short, I was in the military for 5 years, and then my best friend died, and one of the things he wanted to do before he died was read the Bible. So I'm reading it right now, and I'm trying to understand it and going through the whole thing. And my issue I'm coming with now is I agree with pretty much everything he said, but I don't know I'm Catholicism, okay, but which branch of Catholicism? And that's where you're kind of saying it doesn't really matter. So would you recommend it's something like I should just do my own research into each of them and figure out what I agree with the most, you know what I mean, what I take from the Bible and like what I gather from other sources
so,
as well.
So one of the things that your question presumes is that the way to figure out the content of the Christian faith is to start with the Bible as your rule of faith, read it, interpret it, and then go select the Christian body that agrees with your interpretation. Okay? And that's a very common view. And it's widely distributed, and I don't blame you for holding that. I think that misconceives the order of operations, because to begin with, it presumes that the function of the Bible is to serve as our rule or norm of faith. That idea is not actually a biblical idea. You will not find any place in the Bible that says that the Bible that you are holding in your hand right now, that sits on your bedside table, is in fact the norm for Christian faith. The Bible itself doesn't teach that doctrine. That doctrine has a provenance, it has a history. It's actually the brainchild ultimately of Martin Luther in the 16th century. So it's a Protestant doctrine that has a development behind it, but it wasn't the teaching of Jesus. Secondly, it begs the question, what is the Bible? I mean, you go to the bookstore, you grab it off the shelf, you say, well, I know what the Bible is, I just bought one at the local Christian bookstore, right? No, it's not that simple, because as you may or may not be aware, there are competing canons of the Bible with different lists of biblical books. How do you know you have the right one? It isn't a foregone conclusion that you have the right list of books in your Bible to even begin the analysis from, right? So the Bible doesn't say it's the rule of faith. The Bible doesn't give you its own table of contents. And finally, when it comes to the interpretation, let's say that you arrive at a particular interpretation that differs in some respect from mine, which is going to happen. I can't avoid that happening. How do you know whether or not our disagreement about the interpretation of the Bible matters? So there might be some elements where you say, you know, Anders and I can agree to disagree and still be in the same church. But there's something else. Well, hey, if we disagree on that, man, that's the end of the road. We got to split and go our separate ways. How do you know which disagreement is substantive and which is trivial? You have no criterion to make that judgment. That's what a Catholic would call the difference between dogma and an opinion. How do you know when you've encountered a difference is a matter of dogma, and how do you know when there's a matter of opinion? The Bible doesn't tell you that. And there you have no principled way to answer that question. All of this ultimately points to the flaw of the doctrine of sola scriptura, or the Bible alone. And so if your question is, you know, should I begin with my exegesis of the Bible and then pick the church that agrees with it, I think that's a dead-end road, because I think it's premised on a false conception of biblical authority. Now, let me go back to my understanding of Catholicism and the kind of Catholic doesn't matter. There are groups in the world that use the word Catholic in their name, but they do not trace their origins to antiquity, right? So just because someone touts the name Catholic is not sufficient for them to be genuinely Catholic. When I use the word Catholic, I mean those churches that are in active communion with the Bishop of Rome that we call the Pope. And there are some groups that call themselves Catholic that are not in communion with the Pope. If it comes down to, you know, any church that's in communion with the Pope, I think your default position should be to join the Catholic community, the right that is the historical patrimony of your culture. You'd have to have a pretty strong reason not to do that. If you live in the West, that means not, most of the time that's going to be the Roman Catholic Church. Now, if you lived in Greece, if you lived in Ukraine, if you lived in Kerala, India, if you lived in Egypt, then you might join the Coptic Catholic Church or the Syro-Malabar Catholic Church or the Ukrainian Catholic Church or the Ruthenian Catholic Church. But since you live in the Latin West, I think, you know, your presumption should be that you join the Latin Catholic or the Roman Catholic Church.
Tyler, I'd love to send you a little book we have called The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. If you would like a copy of that book, you just have to hang on the line. I have to take a quick break, but lots more great questions coming for Dr. David Anders on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You know, I have never seen women who want to be equal absolutely degrading themselves. And yet the media degrades your nature, your beauty as a woman, your goodness. Let us pray. At some point, our dear Lord touches their hearts.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Dr. David Anders is our guest. Lots of folks on the line for him. I'm going to get to the calls, but I think you should see Dr. David Anders in person. That's the way I feel about it. I think you should see him in person, and I know just the place to do it. He's going to be out here in California in September, the last full weekend of September. We have our Catholic Answers conference each year, and Dr. Anders will be one of the featured speakers this year. So all you have to do is go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. You'll find out all the details. CatholicAnswersConference.com. The one thing I'll tell you is if you buy a ticket, use the promo code EARLY, because you get $50 off your ticket when you use that promo code EARLY at CatholicAnswersConference.com. We're looking forward to you coming out here.
I can't wait. I always love traveling out west. It's such a long way from home and such a different topography, you know. And
yeah,
people are great. The food is great. The geography is great. The conference is going to be great. I'm looking forward to it.
If you like F-35 fighter jets flying over, you'll love this conference because they do the air show at Miramar Station about 5 miles away the same weekend every year. And it terrifies, like, usually we're in the middle of a talk or something and then you hear this. They don't put mufflers on those things. There are no mufflers on the F-35s. They are.
Well, you know. Once your house gets struck by lightning,
you probably have superpowers now. Yeah, I mean, it's called a stealth jet, and every time I hear it, I'm like, that's not stealth. I can hear that coming from like 100 miles away. There's got to be some. You got to work on that. All right, let's go to the next caller. Luke is up in Oregon, listening on the Spirit Catholic Radio app. How cool, Luke! Glad to have you here. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Anders.
Hey, doctor. Pleasure to be here. So every weekend I do a little Bible study with a good friend of mine in Nebraska, and, you know, where we talk basically faith, family, and friendships is how I usually describe it. And your name came up, Dr. Anders, yesterday as I asked him about the way Catholics approach evolution. So if you could elaborate on that for me, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate the question. So it is a dogma of the Catholic faith that nothing in the faith can contradict reason, and nothing in reason can contradict the faith, because the natural order and the supernatural order have God as the one source and origin. And so God's not going to be in contradiction with himself. And so what that means is that if I go out in my backyard and I dig up a fossil and I carbon date that fossil and find that it dates to, you know, I don't know, 100 million years ago, but I've grown up in a fundamentalist church, for example, that teaches me the world is 10,000 years old. Well, I now have empirical evidence that there's something in my backyard that's 100 million years old. And so that means that I've made a mistake someplace. Now, what the fundamentalist does is he just assumes that the mistake has to have been in the science. Right? So I'm just going to chunk the science, and if the world appears to be 100 million years old, well, that's just an appearance. Right. The reality is, well, we know it's only 10,000 years old. The Catholic doesn't do it that way. The Catholic says, if you can show me demonstrably from the empirical science that the Earth is a billion years old or whatever it is, then I must have made a mistake in my biblical exegesis. And the place where this came out most prominently was in the Galileo affair. At the time when Galileo was proposing the Copernican theory of the universe, it had not yet been empirically demonstrated. It was a mathematical hypothesis that made sense of the data, but there was no way to establish that it was the actual empirical physical reality. And Galileo proposed that it was. Well, that went against Aristotle. It went against the best Greek science. It went against the scientific consensus of the day, and therefore it also went against what people's intuitions were about the exegesis of the book of Genesis. And so Cardinal Bellarmine, who was the kind of the head Vatican honcho of doctrine at the time, says about Galileo, he says, well, you know, I think Galileo's probably wrong. But, you know, if we can get empirical evidence that shows that his theory is actually correct, that the physical theory of heliocentrism is correct, then it'll turn out to have been the case that we made a mistake in our biblical exegesis. We're not going to say that Scripture was wrong. We're going to say our reading of Scripture was wrong. And then we will reinterpret the Bible accordingly. We're still going to maintain biblical authority, but we're going to put the fault on ourselves for having misread this passage in this way because the empirical data shows that we were wrong, right? That's an illustration of the way that Catholics are sensitive to the power of both faith and reason. And so when it comes to the empirical evidence for, say, biological evolution from natural selection, which, and I'm not a biologist, but my sense of the data is that the evidence for that theory is just positively overwhelming. then the Catholic, consistent with the Catholic doctrine of faith and reason, says, okay, then that's the way it works. That's the way it works. Now, can that doctrine challenge anything in Catholic faith? Not really. Not really. Pope Pius XII wrote an encyclical on this called On Human Origins, Humani Generis. And at one point, he raises a question. And the point was this: not because of Genesis, not because of Genesis, but because of the doctrine of redemption, the Pope gets a bit weak in the knees, kind of queasy in the stomach, over the question of polygenesis. That is to say, did the human race descend from a single common pair, an Adam and Eve, if you will, or did it have a polygenetic origin, which is the way most species evolve? Now, the scientific data would seem to suggest polygenesis, but the Pope says, yeah, but that kind of pushes back a little bit on the uniqueness of Christ as the second Adam. So I'm not real comfortable with that one aspect. And so he inserts a kind of caution into Catholic theology. And he doesn't sort of categorically forbid, but he says, if you're going to mess around with monogenesis, you have to maintain as a theologian the primacy of Christ as the second Adam and the significance of that parallel. But he gives full permission for Catholic theologians and scientists to speculate about the sort of the pre-Adamite evolution of the hominid genus. And so he has no objection, you know, to the idea that there could be multiple hominid species that evolved over, you know, any number of ages through natural selection. All that's perfectly acceptable to him. But he just presses in on that one question of Christ and Adam. That's sort of the one point where evolution is, we don't throw it away, but we say, okay, as theologians, let's see how we can reconcile that. And he doesn't dogmatize about the way theology has to answer that question, just that it has to be very respectful of that parallel. But, you know, Catholics are not biblical fundamentalists. And you know, biblical fundamentalist takes the Bible as if it were a data set, the way Baconian science functioned. You know, the ideal in Baconian science, you've ever saw Master and Commander and the ship's doctor on that movie who goes around the world and picks up specimens and puts them in cages and then comes back and draws little diagrams and takes them back to the Royal Society and makes reports on them. And that was sort of the idea, you know, on the Beagle with Darwin, that the way you do science is you just collect a bunch of individual data items and you theorize about them. 19th century Protestant theologians speculated the Bible functioned the same way, that the Bible was a collection of facts and propositions, and that the job of the theologian was just to assemble them in a kind of systematic order, and voila, you've got systematic theology. Catholics have never viewed the Bible that way. Never have. Neither did Jesus, neither did St. Paul. And we acknowledge that there is a literal text of the Bible, but literal doesn't mean literalistic, doesn't mean fundamentalist. But moreover, beyond the literal text, there's a narrative of theological development, you know, as the people of God journey in their relationship to God, and there's a development in their understanding of God, and the whole thing has a kind of archetypal significance that finds its ultimate fulfillment in the person of Jesus. And so the proper way to read the Bible is to read it backwards through the lens of Christ. And when we do that, we find that the literal sense sometimes needs to be sort of radically reinterpreted. Jesus himself did this when he read the Old Testament, you know, John chapter 8. Bible says execute people caught in adultery. He says, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. We're not going to take the Bible literally at that level. Old Testament says men can divorce their wives seemingly with impunity. Jesus says, no, we're not going to do that either, right? And so the Catholic Church says that on top of the literal or sort of built into it, there is a spiritual sense of the Testament. And that's actually where all the work gets done. The significance for our lives is in its transformative moral and spiritual power to conform our lives to that of Jesus. And that the proper way to read and engage the Bible in worship is with that transformative end in view, which really does all the work at the ethical and the moral and the spiritual level, and to engage it as if it were a geology text or as if it were a biology text is a massive misreading of the Bible and taking the Bible for something that it was never intended to be.
Luke, I just have about 5 seconds with you. Is that all helpful to you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I wish I could listen to it all over again. Yeah,
you can.
Thank you so much.
It's available as a podcast or on YouTube. Share it with your friends, Luke. I'll tell you what, let's give Luke whatever book of Catholic Answers that he wants. I'd like to send you a book to say thanks for that question. And Dr. David Anders, thank you. It's always such a great pleasure to get to speak with you.
Thank you, Si. Thank you so much.
I'm so glad the devil missed you. I'm so glad he missed you with that lightning bolt.
I'm really glad he did, too.
All right, that'll do it for us. We're going to take a, you know, a little 22-hour break, and then we'll be back, God willing, to do it again. Who's coming tomorrow? Do you remember who we got tomorrow? I had it in my brain. It's Carlo. 2 hours with Dr. Carlo Broussard. We'll do that, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.